Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 170, FDR, part 2. It was spring of 1913, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt was just 31 years old. Born with every advantage in the world, including a gift for ingratiating himself among the powerful, he had not failed to put his talents to good use. During 1912, he had bet on Woodrow Wilson as the horse to back in the Democratic Party, and that had paid off splendidly. Wilson elevated Roosevelt to the position of Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the same stepping stone that Theodore Roosevelt had used on his own way up. The change from Albany to Washington, D.C. would be a whole new environment for FDR. He wasn't running for anything now, and the policy he worked on was narrowed down to just naval affairs, which might have been good for him. His indifference to the array of problems facing his home state had never properly occupied his attention. His boss was Joseph S. Daniels, a politician from North Carolina that might not have known anything about ships, but was an excellent politicker who possessed that southern charm that the blue-blooded Roosevelt might have lacked at that point when working with normal people. The pair actually worked well together, as each possessed a force of will necessary to run a bureau that had been barely modified since the Civil War. Indeed, a big part of the job was managing the various sub-bureaus of the Navy that in turn managed specific technical matters pertaining to the upkeep of the nation's fleets, all of which had a great deal of autonomy. Frustratingly, too, those sub-bureaus also reported to Congress, something FDR tried to change, but wouldn't be able to until after America entered World War II, when he occupied a far higher posting. FDR brought along Lewis Howe as his de facto secretary, and delegated most of the technical duties to him. By that, I mean Howe did the paperwork, which was never going to be Roosevelt's strong suit. Daniels and Roosevelt proved to be effective at bringing the bureaucracy of the Navy, most importantly, the admirals, to heel. When the officers protested to Wilson about Daniels' more hands-on civilian oversight, Wilson went against them. When they tried to pitch Congress on expanding the Navy as World War I approached, they were shot down thanks to Daniels' assertions that military expansion would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. FDR used his new environment to once again expand his network, adding the premier social clubs of Washington to the constellation of New York ones he was already a part of. He even arranged for a naval flotilla to go on maneuvers off of North Maine while he and the family were on vacation. His use of warships as vacation yachts would be something he'd pick back up as president. He even personally assumed the helm of a destroyer and piloted it through the waters between Maine and Canada. The commander of the destroyer was a young William Halsey, who would command the Third Fleet during the Pacific War, and whom I'll have a lot more to speak on in the far future. Halsey reportedly was not thrilled about turning the helm over to Roosevelt, and I cannot blame him, that was a goddamn idiotic stunt, but apparently FDR proved himself capable enough and didn't wreck the ship. All fun aside, it wasn't long before FDR looked for opportunities outside the Navy Department. While he got on well with Daniels, he wasn't one for being the number two of anything and looked back to New York. There seemed to be an opening when a real senator spot, meaning a federal one, opened up in 1914. Without vacating his seat in the Navy Department, he opted to try his hand at that office. Daniels was less than thrilled as war was breaking out across Europe and the Navy was going on to alert. Work was going to be getting a lot more complicated. But still, FDR plunged forward, that is, until Tammany Hall backed their own candidate and forced a primary. James Girard was the ambassador to Germany at the time, and so would be an absentee candidate, seeing as how the US and Germany were neutral to each other and normal diplomatic contact continued. President Wilson, for his part, publicly backed Girard. FDR hadn't expected to do a primary campaign, and Daniels advised him not to stick himself out at such an early stage of his career. Roosevelt ignored the advice and, despite campaigning across New York State, was trounced by an overwhelming majority to a guy who had remained back in Berlin. It was a stinging defeat that probably wasn't helped by Daniels figuratively patting him on the back and telling him to get back to work. When Roosevelt tried to re-energize himself by pushing for the Navy to be better prepared to join the hostilities, Daniels shot him down as the precedent was no peacetime buildup. Only when Wilson himself came out for an accelerated building program in 1915 did Daniels actually backtrack on that, and FDR finally got his wish. The actual outbreak of the war was something of a blessing for FDR. All of a sudden, everybody wanted to talk to the Navy Department. There was a tremendous amount of business being done on account of ship construction, and they were now coordinating with a whole network of foreign allies. Roosevelt made so many new friends. One downside was that work became an all-encompassing affair for Franklin, while Eleanor did her own volunteer work to drum up support for the war effort back in New York. They didn't see a lot of each other. Roosevelt had already started an affair with Eleanor's social secretary, one Lucy Mercer, in the summer of 1916, a posting that conveniently kept her in Washington. While Eleanor was far away, Lucy was right there. And to the agreement of everyone, Lucy was quite the looker and was very private socially. A perfect person to shack up with if you wanted to cheat on your wife, which Franklin did, and their relationship only deepened when the U.S. actually entered the war. He got her a commission with the Navy so that she could be his secretary instead, although inside of a year, Daniels had picked up on the arrangement and had Lucy discharged, with a high rating to show that there were no hard feelings. He didn't tattle on his subordinate, but he wasn't having any of that in his office. Even at a remove, Eleanor was smart enough to know that something was up, and when FDR started finding excuses not to leave Washington, well, that was a pretty clear giveaway that something was going on there. They quarreled and bickered like a couple in trouble were expected to do, but Eleanor didn't have any real proof that Franklin was cheating on her. That is, until he was making a return trip from Europe. He had been away, shuttling between Allied capitals discussing, what else, naval affairs. On the return trip, the crew of the destroyer he was traveling on was devastated by an outbreak of Spanish flu. Not only did he get the flu, he got pneumonia as well. When the ship pulled into harbor, it was a veritable ship of the damned. Roosevelt had to be taken away via ambulance, and he was left to stay at his mother Sarah's New York residence. Eleanor got a hold of his luggage and found his love letters to Lucy. She might have had her very strong suspicions already, but facing the hard truth staring her in the face was a traumatic blow. Their marriage would never recover. Eleanor offered Franklin a divorce soon after, but Sarah intervened. She bluntly told her son that he could expect not another dime from the family fortune should he invite such a scandal. Howe stepped in to try and convince the two to stay together for the sake of their public work. Eleanor was willing to stay married for the sake of their family, while FDR needed to stay for his career. They moved forward together, and Roosevelt would take pains to be a better family man. Not that it mattered all that much. He would still sleep around, and even got back together with Lucy in 1941. She was actually the last person to see him alive. His marriage with Eleanor evolved into a far more of a, a partnership than anything else. By the time he entered the White House, his relationship with her had become formal and awkward, though it never broke down entirely. Indeed, both seemed to make happy lives for themselves, just increasingly apart from one another. In happier events around that time, World War I ended in victory, which meant more work for Franklin in the short term, as the gigantic infrastructure for the Navy that had been built up since spring 1917 had to start being dismantled after less than 2 years of hostilities. America was not going to be preserving the impressive but expensive military that was only just coming fully online. He would be part of the initial delegation that went to Paris with President Wilson, an opportunity to bury the hatchet with Eleanor, as it was a chance for a vacation abroad. Paris makes everything so much better. But even beyond Franklin's affair, it had the feeling of an era ending for both of them. While on the cruise to Paris, they received word over the radio that Theodore Roosevelt had died, aged just 61. This was a blow especially to Eleanor, being the favorite niece and all, plus Teddy effectively being a second father to her, and her mood had already been understandably depressed before the news broke. For Franklin, beyond the loss of his family idol and personal example he was following, the future was just terribly uncertain in general. It was the winter of 1919, and the next year would be another presidential election. He didn't consider himself a contender just yet, but he had a national profile thanks to the Navy Department gig, and he was well-liked. But the Republicans had won heavily in the 1918 midterms, and with no strong leader to replace Wilson among the Democrats, it looked as though they would sail to victory in 1920 as well. He tried to piece together exactly what his next move was. The burdens of the peace conference did not weigh on him terribly. He was part of the delegation, but wasn't there to work on the treaty. He was there to sell off the Navy's European assets, the same as much of them would be sold off back stateside. Facilities from the Azores to the North Sea were sold off to foreign governments, which involved a good deal of haggling, especially with the French. The U.S.'s allies tried to play hardball and wait for the U.S. to simply abandon their facilities intact, leaving behind their equipment that would be expensive to dismantle and ship back home. But Secretary Daniels didn't believe in handouts to foreign governments and threatened to do just that, regardless of cost, forcing the Europeans to pony up at least token amounts for the modern facilities that had been constructed by the U.S. Aside from these talks, the Roosevelts got to enjoy the sights of Paris, which, even in those grim days, were world-class, provided, of course, you had the money, which they did. Until, that is, mid-February, when Wilson returned to the States for a time, which they joined him on that return trip. Once back home, Daniels and Roosevelt swapped places, with the former heading out to Paris to meet with his foreign counterparts. Being the point man in D.C. kept FDR occupied for a solid 2 months, as all the day-to-day business, of which there was tons during the demobilization period, went through him. While the work was boring, D.C. was melting down during the Red Summer of 1919. Racial violence led to outright riots, and the city went under martial law. See episode 118 for more details on that. Shortly before the bulk of the national violence got underway, on June 2nd, an anarchist set off a bomb, in all likelihood prematurely, in front of Attorney General Mitchell Palmer's home. The bomber was borderline disintegrated and his target unharmed. The Roosevelts, though, lived right next door, and after checking to make sure that his own son, James, was all right, Franklin rushed over to help the neighbors. It was a grisly scene, and James would do a very gross kid thing of looking for bone fragments along the street in the days after. Between the bombing and the race riots, the reality of what was lying beneath day-to-day American life must have been hammered home to Roosevelt. And in his defense, he didn't give in to the mindless fear-mongering that swept the country towards the end of the year during the first Red Scare. He overruled an admiral attempting to discharge a trio of socialists from the Navy and supported a socialist professor back in Harvard in his capacity as a member of the university's board of overseers. It was also during the autumn of 1919 that Eleanor became even more active in volunteer work. That would become her outlet given the disappointment her marriage had turned into. She started out devoting time to a local mental health hospital, which, believe me, back in those days did not enjoy even the, imperfect standards we see today. She worked both volunteer hours and in a philanthropic capacity, raising aid from her social network to provide better conditions. This led to her meeting and getting involved in feminist organizations, and in October 1919 acted as a translator for the First International Congress of Working Women. She approached it as a curiosity at the time, but found being surrounded by driven and passionate women exhilarating all the same. She would later reflect how little of an inkling she had about how much of a presence many of them would be in the rest of her life. By then, the Wilson era was coming to a close. The president had been laid low by a stroke, and legislation to approve the League of Nations hung in the balance in Congress. Henry Cabot Lodge, the Senate Majority Leader, was prepared to accept the League, provided some caveats on how the legislation was applied were accepted by Wilson. The president, though, was inflexible and refused even small compromises. The British sent representatives to plead with Wilson to just take the deal. And, well, the president threw those guys out. When FDR invited the delegation over as a social courtesy, the increasingly unbalanced Wilson cut the Roosevelts out of his orbit. Not that it really mattered. With Wilson on the rocks, the cabinet started going its separate ways. We don't like to talk about it in the U.S., but at a handful of times in the nation's history, the executive branch loses cohesion and turns into a dislocated set of bureaus. The end of the Nixon administration is my personal favorite, but Wilson's last year is a good one, too. FDR's mind turned towards returning to elected office once again. The immediate prospects in New York seemed bad on account of the momentum on the Republican side. The idea that intrigued him the most was running as vice president if none other than Herbert Hoover would declare for the Democrats. Hoover was not fully committed to either party, and Roosevelt saw him in 1920 as the one guy with the ability and built-in popularity to score a win among the Democrats. But then Hoover declared himself Republican and opted not to go for the presidency at that time, so that bizarro history never came to pass. At the 1920 Democratic Presidential Convention, FDR passionately supported his fellow New Yorker Al Smith for the nomination. Smith, who was one of Tammany's bigwigs, didn't wind up getting the nomination, but greatly appreciated an impassioned public speech from FDR, portraying them as old friends and party comrades. While FDR had largely made his peace with the Tammany clique before going to Washington, he and Smith had never been as close as he had suggested in his speech. The kind words, though, went a long way to building a bridge. Just a side note, as FDR gained a national profile, he and Tammany Hall came to recognize mutual benefits from not tearing each other down. FDR needed Tammany's votes. Tammany would later get a little shine from FDR's personal popularity. Roosevelt would eventually turn his back on them after, of course, they had outlived their usefulness to him. The eventual nominee, James Cox, was the one to personally select Roosevelt as his running mate, with the enthusiastic support of Al Smith. Cox was the governor of Ohio and so covered the Midwest. The addition of Roosevelt would be a plus for the Northeast, while the party could count on the solid South. The very name Roosevelt was calculated to command recognition across the entire country. So, despite FDR's young age and scant electoral record, it seemed to fit. As I covered last season, they didn't stand a chance, but they gave it a shot. Regardless of the outcome, becoming the vice presidential nominee increased FDR's profile immeasurably. Daniels was on hand to anoint him, and Hoover, despite going Republican, offered him public congratulations. While he was only running for VP, he threw himself into campaign mode. He resigned from the Navy Department and crisscrossed the nation, delivering almost 1,000 speeches. He was sure to name-drop his dearly departed cousin Theodore to cement himself in the minds of others, and even if the 1920 election didn't go his way, people were sure to know who he was after. His main gaffe came when he bragged about his gunboat diplomacy in the Caribbean. Warren Harding got him good when he promised that under a Republican administration, assistant naval secretaries wouldn't be running roughshod over smaller neighbors, which, hey, that is the correct take. Eleanor, meanwhile, took a little time to grow into a political personage in her own right. On account of being dominated by the Southeast, the Democrats were badly conservative when it came to women's issues, and despite women voting in presidential elections for the first time, they didn't make an organized appeal to them. Meanwhile, the Republicans were running their himbo, Warren Harding, who had some kind of old-timey power to make women of that era very thirsty. Lewis Howe, on the other hand, came from a background of two-bit journalism and did not share the inhibitions of his boss's party. He ran speeches and ideas by Eleanor to get a bit of feminine input, which got her more into a politician's mindset. It also brought her closer to Howe, who had been for a decade at that point the little manlet following her husband around, like a Renfield or something. Only upon actually getting to work with him did she discover he was an actual human being with his own inner life, and this marked the point where they became devoted friends. The eventual defeat in the election was so predictable that I'm not even going to linger over it. For the Roosevelts, it was notable mostly in that it formed a circle of early supporters for the future, and FDR was already looking in that direction. While he secured an executive position at a bonding company after the election, that was at best a part-time job that he collected a handsome salary from. Even his employers understood he was going to go far in politics, and they just wanted to be friends early on. Eleanor, meanwhile, joined the League of Women Voters. FDR would stay active in affairs in the Democratic Party, while becoming an active philanthropist on top of that. In that vein, on a trip to the annual Boy Scout Jamboree at the end of July 1921, he traveled out into the backcountry of New York to act as the master of ceremonies. It was there that he picked up a virus that would start incubating inside of him. And yes, I'm finally getting to his case of polio. On August 5th, 1921, about a week after the Jamboree, FDR and the family headed out to Campobello, the traditional family vacation spot. Franklin felt like crap and was looking forward to the break. At first, he soldiered on as if nothing was happening. He did the usual outdoorsy stuff, no problem. Then, towards the end of the day, on the 10th, things took a turn for the worse. After a day of swimming and other physical exertion, FDR was totally exhausted and not in the normal way you'd expect. He took a chill and shivered himself to sleep. The next morning, his legs wouldn't support his weight, and he was running a high fever. The local country doctor told him he had a cold. By the evening of the 12th, he couldn't move his legs. A nationally celebrated surgeon was vacationing nearby, and he was summoned to check on him. Being a surgeon doesn't qualify you to diagnose polio, and so Dr. Number 2 also failed to determine what was going on. He suggested massages. It didn't work, and Franklin's fever went out of control. He lost feeling in his arms and couldn't control his bodily functions. For Eleanor, it was up to her to take care of him, but thankfully, Howe and his family were also among the vacationing entourage, and so was on hand to help her out. Howe suggested they get somebody more qualified out there pronto. They rang up the office of Dr. Robert Lovett, who was a professor of orthopedic surgery at Harvard, and his team there immediately confirmed, based on the description, that he had polio. Lovett arrived on August 25th to make the confirmation in person. As the weeks wore on, Lovett would remain in contact and gently try and get the point across to both Franklin and the family that recovery was going to be a relative thing. Roosevelt would very likely never walk again. In mid-September, FDR was shuttled to New York in a private train car, out of sight of the press. This was 1921, and being seen with a handicap was a political death sentence. There was a whole taboo about disabilities, and people could not see a national leader in someone bound to a wheelchair. The press had caught wind that something was up, but only knew that there was just a grave illness. The Roosevelts checked in with a Dr. George Draper, a student of Lovett's, to get his opinion. While Draper could not give any better news, he did the Roosevelts a solid by telling the papers that FDR was far from a cripple and could expect to bounce back with no permanent injury, which is exactly what got reported in the New York Times. The reality was another matter, though. He got the use of his arms back, but the fever didn't start going down until early October. He was only discharged from the hospital October 28th and was bound to a wheelchair. By December, he was able to haphazardly get around on crutches. He came to depend on the work of Eleanor and Howe, who, through the ordeal, developed an almost sibling-like relationship as they kept the whole Roosevelt project going. Recovery was slow. In March 1922, he was fitted with cumbersome braces, and he spent all his time trying to regain as much of his body's capability that he could. He would become enamored with the small Georgian town of Warm Springs, which, true to its name, boasted naturally warm pools of water. He would spend the rest of his life traveling there to vacation and to try to build strength back into his legs. It never actually panned out, but that didn't stop him from investing $200,000 of the family fortune into improving the facilities there. The state of the place was a little rustic for the family's tastes when he first started going there, Eleanor's especially. Understandably, there wasn't a lot going on beyond recuperating. Eleanor expanded her work to press for women to have a public place in Democratic Party politics. Howe managed FDR's affairs back in the office. He was still a force in the Democratic Party as well, and his public support of Al Smith once again during the 1922 election for the state governorship was warmly welcomed with an equally public thank you. FDR made his first appearance outside his home in October 1922 when he went back to work in New York City. It didn't go well. He dragged himself with crutches while wearing his braces, and despite every ounce of physical exertion, a leg still gave out and he smashed into the marble floor of the building's lobby. It was a rough start to his rebooted public life. The 1924 Democratic Presidential Convention, though, held out some promise to getting back on the map for real. Listeners of this show will remember back in episode 120 that this convention was a disaster for the party, but it was a triumph for FDR personally. Smith was running for the nomination, and he picked Roosevelt to chair his campaign. Roosevelt's son James was on hand to help his dad enter the actual convention space on foot, to hide that the entire trip up to that point was done in a wheelchair. His 34-minute nomination speech on behalf of Smith electrified the crowd and sent the place into roars of approval, the rare moment of party unity for that convention. It was reported that people forgot Roosevelt wasn't himself up for nomination because they wanted him in that moment. Smith wouldn't get the nomination that time around, and he went back to running for re-election as New York governor. But again, it was a nice comeback for FDR himself. Using the podium for support, he and James realized they hadn't actually planned on how to get away from the stage. Luckily, a sympathetic Frances Perkins was in the audience, and she and another lady went to the stage to form a kind of human curtain while people were preoccupied so that James could hustle the wheelchair to the back of the stage and get his dad the hell out of there. It was a little sweaty, but they'd get better at doing that sort of thing. A lot of practice was in their future. In the meantime, though, they were still feeling things out. No pun intended. There weren't a lot of high-profile political openings, and FDR mostly bided his time. His work in the office was half-hearted at best, though again, this was a case where his bosses saw him as an investment, and he was personally making a lot of good friends. The 1928 presidential election came around, and Smith finally became the Dems' candidate. It was another doomed venture in the face of national prosperity accredited to the Republicans, but it did create an opening in the New York governorship. FDR was leery about running for it, though, as the odds were still stacked against the Democrats. His own plan was to run for governor in 1932 and for president in 1936. The assumption was that Hoover would win two terms very easily in 1928 and 32. Still, the party needed Smith to at least carry New York, or the downstream votes would cripple the Democrats statewide. They pressed FDR to get into the fray early and run for governor immediately. Lacking viable candidates, even Tammany Hall refused to accept anyone other than Roosevelt. In a notable exchange, both Smith and John Raskob, who would both become bitter enemies of Roosevelt by 1932, phoned him to plead that he run. Smith assured him that all he needed to do was to be president for the brief legislative window, and then he can go back to recuperating. Raskob promised to pay for the campaign. When FDR still balked at their pleas, Smith finally got down to the point. He asked that if the party nominated him, even while he was absent, would he turn them down? FDR didn't say anything in reply, and Smith knew he had him. He understood Roosevelt was ambitious as all hell. When push came to shove and the nomination was offered on a silver platter, Roosevelt couldn't say no, and they all knew it. Howe went to work, and they got to campaigning. Moving by train and by car, they were able to shield the public from Roosevelt's disability, and by 1928, he had more than enough strength to work night and day. People responded to him. Keep in mind that this was his first election since running for re-election to the state Senate 16 years previous. He had grown enormously as a speaker and politician, helped no doubt by rubbing shoulders with the best in the business at the national level while in Washington. Francis Perkins was amazed at the turnaround from a wishy-washy state senator to the gubernatorial candidate she now saw. When election day came, it was a nail-biter all the same, just because the odds were so stacked against the Democrats. For the longest time during the vote counting, it looked like FDR would lose, but at 4 a.m., the count had shifted in his favor. He won by 25,000 votes, just a little over 0.5% of the 4 million total counted. Consider that America doesn't smile too often on electoral losers and consider how a loss might have derailed his future. When we cover the long story of the New Deal, it's worth keeping in mind just how much of a close-run thing all of it was just getting Roosevelt to the presidency. And while the governorship might have been seen as a close stepping stone to president, he first had to prove himself in that office. The first problem was actually Al Smith. He had handily lost the presidential race, one in which only he thought he was going to win. He was out of office, many of his old allies were retiring or dying, and he himself was getting old. But he couldn't let go just yet, especially since FDR was so inexperienced in the kind of office he was entering. Smith maintained a residence in Albany and leaned on Roosevelt to bring on some of his own people for his office staff. Roosevelt immediately grasped that Smith was angling to play puppet master. FDR grasped that he had done better than Smith or the party in general in the election, and correctly deemed that the office was his and his alone. While he kept on many party loyalists from Smith's administration in the agencies, he kept his own counsel when it came to running things from the governor's office. He also started installing some of his core people into positions closest to him. Howe was a given, but he also brought on board Francis Perkins and Henry Morgenthau, people who would work under him for the rest of his life. Smith would become increasingly marginalized, and the elder statesman would realize that he had reached the inflection point where the junior political partner was overtaking him, which Smith did not take well. Roosevelt's governing style would mirror how he operated as president. The governor's mansion became something of an open house to the connected, and FDR himself loved treating guests as just that, guests, which meant you could expect a warm welcome, but also maybe a lot of meandering conversation and coming away with the feeling you didn't really accomplish a whole lot in speaking with him. If you wanted to push policy, going through FDR's staff was the best bet. Eleanor, for her part, was less than thrilled with the change. She had been focusing on Smith's campaign, and his defeat meant her own ambitions for national reform would be thwarted for the time being. Worse, she would be expected to be a first lady of the state, and not the crusader she had blossomed into. Her husband recognized that her profile was growing, and reflexively tried to get her to retreat a little back into being mostly his supporter, to which she gently chided him, "You really should be proud of me, dear. What I'm getting at is that she didn't have a great deal to do, and it kinda drove her crazy." Not that Franklin was burdened with too much responsibility either. Smith had been governor from the start of 1919 to the end of 1928, excepting a two-year absence from 1921 to 22. The state's executive had been reshaped by him and largely ran itself, so FDR didn't need to keep too firm a hand on the levers of power. He had become skilled at distilling politics into digestible pitches, which he delivered to great effect in his radio addresses to the state, which would be a preview of his national fireside chats. He started playing with populist rhetoric, warning of the nation's wealth being concentrated in so few hands. He was very much just testing the waters with that messaging, but it would not be long before that kind of talk would be what defined him as a politician. Because it wouldn't be too long before 1929 happened. FDR dismissed the stock market crash as just a correction. A couple months later, things seemed much more serious. By January, he was setting up a new state commission to manage relief aid. He was among the first of the country's leaders to grasp this crisis was not going away. He established the Temporary Relief Agency, or TERRA, to manage the state's financial aid to the needy. Money was raised, taxes increased, and it was very much a preview for the upcoming New Deal. On a smaller scale, that is. Even with a state as large as New York, there was only so much that could be done at that level. To ward off accusations of socialism, he placed a former executive of the Macy's department store in charge of the agency. His national call for the federal and state governments to begin thinking outside the box and experiment with far-reaching reforms was a direct challenge to Hoover's own response. Hoover would fume that the governor of New York was calling for state planning on the Russian model, an assessment that pro-business Democrats like John Raskob agreed with. The disaster also meant that FDR crushed his opposition in the 1930 re-election campaign for the governorship. That win cemented him as the presidential frontrunner in 1932. Before 1931 was even out, FDR was making overtures to party bosses across the nation. Al Smith and John Raskob openly turned on Roosevelt at this time, completely missing the national mood and favoring a moderate response to the Great Depression. Closer to home, and by that I mean inside the home, Eleanor was despondent over what seemed to be an inevitable presidential run. If the duties of being First Lady of the state of New York had been suffocating, then the ones for First Lady of the country would be all the worse. By some accounts, she considered divorcing Franklin, but understood doing so would destroy him politically. With no small urging from Howe, she resigned herself to what was ahead of her and agreed to ride the currents carrying all of them. FDR himself was not so sure that his candidacy was a given. Al Smith was furiously jockeying against him, and if the nomination convention was dragged out, then there was a danger the party would decide they were going to win no matter who they ran and select a compromise candidate. His main trump card was that he was indeed the obvious frontrunner, far more than Smith, who frankly deluded himself into believing he was actually the man of the hour. Even before his nomination, FDR attracted a long queue of national notables, politicians, businessmen, academics, you name it, to try and catch the ear of the presumptive next president. He held court to such an extent and made vague pronouncements after each meeting so often that he was accused of not actually believing in anything or having a coherent plan. Which the former was untrue, while the latter was a fair point. One thing to know about the New Deal, it was kind of an ad hoc thing. Very experimental, as he himself would put it. But he was very firm on promising change and lots of it, which was a damn sight more than what his rivals offered. I covered the convention and touched on the 1932 election back in episode 125, so I won't repeat the details here. And there isn't much of a point in belaboring those events anyway. Roosevelt crushed his opposition and easily rode into the presidency with supermajorities in both houses of Congress. Landslides are hard to make interesting, so I won't even bother here. But winning the presidency turned out to be the easy part. Actually making something of it in the midst of the greatest national crisis since the Civil War was another matter entirely. which is why next week I'll be picking back up with the main narrative and cover the lame duck period leading up to FDR swearing in. Which, usually those periods are uneventful, but this time around it was anything but. Expect a lot of backbiting, plotting, and a deepening of the depression that almost broke America apart before FDR could even take office. Join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening.